Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I sit down with a couple of UK pastors, Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham. A little bit of a throwback to the days of ordinary apologetics in our main section today. We're going to be talking about the absurdity of life without God, arguing that if God does not exist, then life is ultimately meaningless and without value. But before that, we have the good old Sunday roundup and some reflections on the conflict between Palestine and Israel in the news section. Enjoy the episode. I'll catch you on the other side.
I'm Mark Bentham.
And I'm Graham Nichols.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Welcome back to the podcast. How are you two doing? I'm still here this week. No live jingles for you once again. I know you were looking forward to that, but I'm still here. He had a good day.
Still standing.
I know Mark's been busy this morning. He's a bit fried, are you, Mark?
I'm all right. I'm in there. It's the Zoom fatigue.
Yeah.
But we're all right.
Yeah, I've been in a Zoom meeting, but I'm doing all right. I'm energised. I've got a meeting with Mark after this, so I'll be dull and dismal by then, I think.
Yeah, well, if you could just squeeze out 30 minutes of gold, then that would be amazing. And then you can crash for the rest of the day. I don't care about the rest of the day.
30 minutes of sheer joy and energy and enthusiasm, because it's exactly. The podcast.
Yes, sir. Only once a week. Right, yeah. Let's kick ourselves off with a Sunday roundup.
Sunday roundup, sure, get the sermon pass real slow. Did you plant some seed to grow? It's roundup time, what do you know?
So this Sunday we were looking at continuing our studies in Matthew. We're at the first four verses of chapter 6 and thinking about, although Jesus talks about particularly giving, he starts in verse 1 about not practicing our righteous deeds, righteous acts in front of man for their glory. Otherwise you won't get reward from our Father in heaven. So we just spent some time thinking about what does that mean? What does it look like to not practice righteous deeds in front of others? Why that's not a good thing. How it gives self-worship, self-glory, and we're much rather wanting to be about giving glory to the Father, but recognising that actually it's quite difficult, and then just seeing how once that Jesus establishes that principle comes true in giving, in terms of how we give in secret, the right hand, left hand, kind of the reflection that actually it's also guarding against self-praise, so maybe no one sees my giving, but I can boast inwardly think how great I am, and just seeking the Father's eternal reward of his praise, his well done, good and faithful servant. So that's where we were.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how your community group was last night, Graham, but ours had quite a lot of interesting avenues as well about what it means to thank people or how you would compliment people in certain ways. Because one of the things we sort of got to eventually was that it could sound like you should never, ever give someone a compliment or say you like something because you'd be worried about making them prideful or arrogant, but actually that it's about the way that you do that, and that is still a really important thing. Like being an encourager is actually a valuable asset and a really important thing.
Yeah, we had a really good discussion about that and about some other things to do with giving and how much you give and the way you give sacrificially and other things. It's not just about money, but I gave a rather crass example of that. I had to lend my trainers, a nice pair of trainers, to Pedro, because he got soaking wet going to Zigzag. So there was a long and drawn out explanation of how embittered I'd become about giving away one of my new pairs of trainers for an evening.
You're a generous man.
Which then turned into probably me boasting about it. But I was more confessing the fact that I was hesitant and Caroline was more generous about it. But yeah, we had lots of good discussions about all that stuff. And about heart attitude, really, about why you're doing it. And I think we can all give little nervous ticks, which are indicating I need a bit of affirmation here.
Right.
Can't we? Can't we? We
Never.
Can. Yes, affirm me.
Well done, Graham. You're doing really well.
I praise God for that comment that came through you.
I'd like to acknowledge God giving me the genius mind to be able to work that out.
Indeed.
Time for news now. Give us your views. News.
Something that's dominating news at the moment is the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Obviously, an extremely complex issue that we're not going to get into in this podcast, but some reflections on that, or the way that it's being handled in the media, or the way that people were talking about it, guys. No one wants to say anything. You both look terrified.
Because it's highly sort of political.
I understand that.
Discussion.
Well, I think when you see this, you realise as well that this issue, you know, at its very, very simplest, kind of boiling it right down about land, mm-hmm. and you know, reading through like the book of Kings and Chronicles at the moment, as I am, and you kind of see how God promises this land to Israel, but actually He also, you know, says if they disobey, He'll kick them out, and He does. And then, of course, the fulfillment of the land through Christ. You realise actually the Christian hope of Christ fulfilling it takes it away from a physical land, but to a glorious splendour of the new heavens, the new earth, and away from this sense of this is where the fulfillment is all on this particular piece of land in the world. But actually, the promises are so much greater and so much bigger. So I think in my mind, when I see this, there's a tragedy about it because it stems from a not seeing who the Messiah truly is. Because if you saw who Christ is, the sense potentially of this preciousness of this particular land, some of it would ease. Now, I know that's simplistic and reductionistic, but I think there is an element of that from a biblical. And I think it's just striking how the press push it. Notice that as an Arsenal fan, one of our players, who is Egyptian, tweeted just support for Palestine and the pro-Palestine cause, and was immediately kind of rebuked by the club, by one of the sponsors, because it was deemed anti-Semitic. So it's really interesting just how the flavour goes, that, you know, it's not a case of if you're on one side or the other, there's a real lots of other political stuff going on in it that I think we just need to be aware of. I'm not even sure what that means. It's just interesting to see how kind of what a touch paper this is, just how tragic it is. And remembering all of this, there's Israeli Christians, Palestinian Christians, and remembering all of this, that ultimately, you know, Jesus was a Jew, so there is something of in Romans 9 about just that there will be maybe potential insert of Jews coming in near the end time. So just praying for that, praying for those people, but praying for both sides, for peace in that land, but ultimately for people to see the true Messiah. Because on both sides, Jews and Muslims in that, if they saw who Christ truly was, a lot of this would go away.
Yeah. It is the thing to do with the tweet and the response is probably more to do with the cultural thing about cancel culture generally, where anything that might be deemed to be sensitive, sort of advertisers, media generally are sort of completely on. So anti-Semitism is a kind of flashpoint at the moment, but it has
been interesting if it had tweeted out pro-Israel, whether that had been... I kind of suspect that would have been all right.
Mm. Yeah, it's complicated because Israel is a kind of recognisable state, and it's more complex with Palestine because it's not actually a country. And there's all sorts of reasons for that, but it's not a country in its own right, so it's sort of a terrorist organisation. But maybe for good laudable reasons. I actually can't work out where to land either on it, in the sense of some Christians would be so pro-Israel, they would just think, you know, they need all the land and some, and that's fine.
That would be a Zionistic view and a sense of, and actually a real view of the reading the Bible in terms of the land is still important, physical land.
Yes, some would. And so that they would then say, well, you know, there shouldn't be any harm to anyone, but basically the Palestinians have no right. Some might just argue from a historical point of view that this is historically Israel's land. And so the Palestinians thing was a temporary group. And anyway, it wasn't really one nation. It was just, you know, various tribal groups. It wasn't really a nation of Palestine there. So some people argue historically, and then other people might say, yeah, like you're sort of half saying, it doesn't matter much. their land, so that you just need to sort of work it out on an equitable peace basis, you know, what physically would work. But yeah, it is complicated because we don't discuss most countries in quite the same way. There's disputes all the time going on in Syria and Afghanistan and loads of other places in the world which don't attract the same interest. So there is something about Israel that's kind of...
Well, and I think partly, you know, is because of the way in which they have, the Jews have been treated historically over the years, which has been appalling. You know, there is no doubt about that, isn't there? And of course we have, you know, some kind of connection there. You know, Jesus was a Jew. So it's not like we're kind of, you know, there is a resonance for us as believers to some degree. Mm. I think it's just a really complex issue. You know, like I just, it's a tragic sadness, or just a reflection of a broken world as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we need to keep praying about it.
But thanks, Josh.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for throwing you in and then just staying silent for the entire chat. Okay, cool. Let's have our main section. In fact, exciting times, guys, because it's going to be not the main section jingle, but the return, long-awaited return, of the apologetics jingle. Ordinary. Apologetics
for the ordinary.
So in the main section today, we're talking about the absurdity of life without God. And although it's not really an argument, we're not going to be coming up with sort of a set of premises and a conclusion that you could use in a conversation. It's more of a chance, I think, to try and uncover and explore this idea that if you remove God, that life becomes meaningless, valueless, and ultimately kind of absurd. And I think this is an idea, ultimately, that a lot of people who would be, I suppose, agnostic or atheist, maybe don't consider. And so it's kind of useful as a Christian, I think, to understand what it means if you take God out of the picture, what that means for life, what that means for value, for meaning, and for purpose. And then it's, I think, quite useful to have that in your back pocket when you're talking to people. You know, where do you find meaning in life? Where do you find purpose? What gives value to human beings and things of that nature? So that's kind of where we're heading in the discussion. It's kind of an open discussion, like I said, not strictly an argument, but I think still useful apologetically and in evangelism. I think to kick it off, the questions that are sort of at the heart of this are questions like, who am I? Why am I here? And where am I going? The really fundamental questions of life that people have been trying to answer for millennia, but I guess since the Enlightenment, people have sought to answer without reference to God, trying to leave God out of that. And I suppose where we're going to go and what we're suggesting is that the answers, when you take God out, are not exciting or free of the oppression of religion. They're actually very dark, very hopeless answers. What you find is when you take God out, there's no reason for your existence. If ultimately you're going to die and pass out of existence, and as science tells us, there'll be a heat death of the universe and it will no longer exist, then ultimately there's no reason, purpose, or meaning to your life now. And so let's flesh out that a little bit first, that idea of the Enlightenment and taking God out of the picture and where that leaves us. So let's start there. Do you have any thoughts on that? What that world is like when you remove God? What do you lose that people might not necessarily imagine they've lost when they remove God from the picture?
Yeah, I think, as you say, but yeah, just to flesh out, I agree with all that you've said. Flesh out a bit more, so to speak.
Please do.
Human flesh. We are created. That's our worldview as Christians. We are created, and we're created special in God's image. And we're created with a moral purpose. And so those are some of the things you've taken away. So there's no creator. And you might think, well, that's okay to not have a creator. But actually, once you start to think about it, it means, okay, so there was no creative purpose. And there's no created order, and there's no created meaning, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I think the distinction one is also really interesting, because we were created in God's image. And I was just listening to someone speaking this morning from a Hindu background. They were just mentioning about the law that's coming in to do with sentient animals, and there's going to be no live transport and so on. And they were just making the point that basically animals are pretty much the same as us, sentient animals at least. And I was thinking, we've got no more basis for saying sentient animals are like us than you've got from saying a fly is, you know, just as many moral rights as us. And I was kind of imagining this human being sort of paralyzed, thinking, I don't know what I am to the rest of creation. I'm just the same.
Mm.
It's just, I'm just in a bit of a bigger lump, but there's nothing distinctive about me. And animals have got as many rights as I have, so I shouldn't kill them, eat them. And maybe, you know, maybe even squeezing this tomato is some kind of moral failure, because I've got no criteria to work out what's the difference between me and a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, like, I agree with everything. It just strikes me as we're talking that actually it's worth just saying that, and I think it would be fair, that actually no one ever really tracks down this kind of... So what we're doing today is kind of pushing to the nth degree, because no one really holds to this. Because actually what most people do is they have some view and they're tracking, or, you know, on the basis of some kind of God figure, moralistic. So what we're doing is that there's probably not anyone who would go to this nth degree of holding, because most people are inconsistent in their thinking, including believers. And so, because you may be listening and thinking, well, yeah, but no one actually holds that. But that's the point of this, is to show the absurdity, to help someone see if they're actually being consistent with what they're believing, of saying there is no God, then actually this is what you should really be truly thinking. Would that be fair?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but I think you get hints of it. So I think it's not quite so academic, in that you are getting hints of it with the whole animal rights movement, and actually with climate science, where...
As in, we'll begin to see where this is cashing out, as it were, the kind of tracked out view, but probably no one holds to the nth degree of everything, because actually there are some who would, actually. You know, there are guys, ethicists in the US, is it Peter... I want to say Stringer, but that doesn't sound right.
Singer.
You know, who would kind of hold to that we're all equal, and therefore how we treat animals, it should be the same as humans, because actually we're all kind of biologically the same.
And there are also people. There are also people who are nihilists, right? Who would hold that God doesn't exist, and therefore everything is meaningless. And although that's an extreme philosophical position, there are figures throughout history who have held to a view like that. But I think a really interesting example to flesh out your point, Mark, is like the philosopher Bertrand Russell, who essentially claimed or believed that moral values are expressions of personal taste, which we'll get into in a little bit, because without God, you have no foundation for those. So you end up saying, well, they're just social. It's either taste or biological evolution or social conditioning. But he admitted, as somebody who believed that he could not live with that as a reality. He couldn't do it. And he called his own view, he said of his own view, it's incredible, I don't know the solution. So on the one hand, he wanted to say, I don't believe God exists, and therefore, rightly, I must say that there is no foundation for moral values and all these things, meaning, purpose. But he said, in the other hand, I cannot live with that view. Like, it's incredible that I hold that view, because that's not how I experience the world. And he didn't have a solution to reconcile those two things. So he's somebody who's obviously not a layperson. Like, he's gone down the track and thought about it a lot. Whereas I think you're right, Mark, most people haven't done that. But they do want to say something like, yeah, I don't believe that God exists. But they don't understand the implications of that. They don't understand the absurdity of life without God. And I think that's what I want to bring out in this discussion.
And see what they're actually tracking on.
Exactly.
See, actually, that the stuff that they're actually kind of thinking and allowing is actually only possible because there is some sense of...
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. Graham, you look like you wanted to say something a minute ago. Although you just put your... Oh, look at him, he's in mess.
I was going to say that on the question of meaning, again, like Mark said, not everyone's thinking, oh, what's the meaning of my life? Yeah. But people are making up meaning narratives. Most people are not thinking, well, logically, my life is meaningless, so it doesn't really matter whether I live or die.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even quite saying, well, I'll just completely immerse myself in pleasure and that's all there is. They might have moments of that, but they do instinctively, we do instinctively think life does have meaning. So we kind of make up little narratives to our meaning is our contribution, or our meaning is our good works, or our meaning is our pleasure that we achieve, or the relationships that we have, the impact we have in the world. So they kind of make up, perhaps not, you know, they don't write them down, but kind of little meaning narratives. My family is my meaning.
Yes.
You know, procreating, having children, grandchildren, networks, is the thing, or enjoying my hobby is the meaning of life. So you create little kind of narratives to say this means something.
Yes.
Most people not thinking, well, actually, if I'm just a bunch of chemicals, this doesn't have any meaning. It doesn't matter whether I win this tennis match or lose it. It doesn't matter whether I achieve this grade or not.
Yeah.
It's all purposeless. It doesn't matter whether this person loves me or hates me.
Yeah.
It has no significance.
Yes.
But no one lives like it, because you're all, well, not you're all, but anyone listening is thinking, no, I don't think like that.
And you really see this at the end of life.
Yes.
And you see it particularly at non-believers' funerals, that the kind of stuff that is then spoken and said, you know, they're still here, they're in the room next door. You know, the kind of the songs and stuff that they sing actually reflect that they want something else. The thought that their loved one has just, that's it, end of, in the ground, you know, as, you know, Dawkins, you know, famously said, you know, well, what was it, Dawkins, you know, just, you know, you might, you know, just going to become a feeder for worms, you know, live life how you want, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, no one actually, very few, should I say, actually think that when their loved one dies. They don't. They're all wishing for and looking, because there is an internal sense within us. That's what.
And I think that's what this conversation is useful for. It's like, because as you're talking, I'm almost pulling premises and conclusions together. Like the premises being, if God does not exist, then there is no meaning, no purpose, no value to life. But there is meaning, purpose, and value to life. We all know that. Like you said, the secular person at a funeral, they speak in a way that reveals they do believe there is meaning and value and purpose. That is not their actual foundation, their belief. And so conclusion, so therefore God exists. It's like the two don't go together. And I think like it's kind of important to just reinforce again the idea that I think relative meaning is almost was what you're talking about, isn't it, Graham? Relative, subjective meaning can exist. So you can do something in the world that is important relative to other events in the world. But the point about the absurdity is that if all events are ultimately doomed to non-existence, to destruction, to the heat death of the universe, then that means they are ultimately meaningless. Even if they have some relative or subjective meaning now, ultimately in the big picture, they absolutely do not. And so the kind of catchphrase that Bill Craig uses sometimes is, because we end in nothing, we are nothing, which I think is understandable. It makes sense.
Yes. I went, just to a corollary to that, I went to a humanist funeral a few years ago.
Okay.
Totally humanist, not just someone who wasn't a believer, but that was organised as a humanist funeral. So, you know, they had a couple of bits of music that were definitely not hymns, and there was no religious element at all. Mm. But weirdly, it did seem significant to celebrate the life and to talk about this person's achievements. And it's kind of his family, and it's his kind of significance, lasting significance, which is really weird and inconsistent, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And I think like, what we get to with this view is, and again, like Mark helpfully says, this is not people's view, but what we're doing is pushing it to its logical implications to try and highlight the fact that it doesn't make sense, okay? Is to say that if all ends in nothing, then it makes no difference how you live. It makes no difference if you live like a Joseph Stalin or a Mother Teresa. It makes no difference. Yeah. If it ends in nothing, it is nothing. And so moral values become either an expression of personal taste or the sort of byproducts of biological evolution and social conditioning. And so we can no longer talk about whose values are right and wrong. It's just completely subjective. And so what that you're left with is just that like moral equivalence. It on this view, like there is no ultimate difference between murdering someone and loving someone. If it all ends in nothing, then it's all meaningless. It has the same amount of the same sum at the end, you know, it comes to nothing, which again is not how people feel, right? People know that murder somebody is not the same as to love them. But
what was weird was the yesterday morning, I was reading, it was a quote from Richard Dawkins, the atheist punchbag, we'll call him for us to this again. But he basically said a few years ago, it would be immoral to allow a Down syndrome baby to come into the world. It's more moral to abort them. And he was interviewed very recently by somebody who, and he kind of then softened it a bit to say, well, maybe saying it's immoral was a bit strong, but something like, it would be better if you aborted that baby.
Right.
Better for the world. And what was interesting was, in a sense, he was being consistent, sort of. But the fact that he even perceived that there was such a thing as moral good and moral evil was pretty fascinating. And the fact that he felt awkward because he felt perhaps he made a moral mistake in quite how strongly he expressed it. I mean, it was all just a jumble of ridiculousness in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it was a horrible statement to make. And he just felt the personal pain because the guy I was interviewing, I think, had a Down syndrome child.
Right.
It was in the last couple of weeks, so you'll sort of find it online. But yeah, who's to say what's morally better out of those two options?
Yeah.
You can maybe have a utilitarian argument, like, it, you know, it uses up less of the world's resources unnecessarily. But then even that's creating a moral framework that says something about the most healthy people are the ones that should survive. That's a kind of moral judgment.
Yeah.
And it's striking, isn't it, the culture right now, is that
yeah.
you can be very tolerant of lots of things apart from something that you think hinders what you don't like. You know, there is a sense of, well, it doesn't really matter. You can live however you want until someone disagrees with me, which seems to curve my particular way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You either personally create a morality, or the state or commercial organisations create a morality for you.
Mm-hmm.
So at least you can kind of live in some way.
And
so at the moment, the state and big business is pretty much defining morality.
And what is that leaving us with, do you think? Obviously, the Enlightenment was a big change of thinking in terms of the kind of, I suppose, the outworking of the Nietzschean idea of the death of God and what that means for society. But in what ways are we seeing that the confusion that's been left in the place of what used to be God's standards, God's morality? Yeah. What kind of things are we seeing that are confusing in the culture? I mean, there are a million things coming to my mind that are absolutely
a new kind of totalitarianism, mm-hmm. really. I mean, you see it with the Donald Trump censoring, in that, should he be allowed to say things that are wrong? Should someone be allowed to say, I don't think the vaccines are very effective? Or should they be shut down? And COVID has allowed both the state and commercial organisations to choose to shut down. Similar things to do with kind of moral judgments. So you've still got, it's almost like you've gone from Dark Ages, Roman Catholicism, totalitarian religious kind of repression to a sort of secular morality repression that's defined by I don't know who.
Mm.
Well, and interestingly, it's often being defined by, as you said, big business.
Yeah.
And as if people are happy with that because they somehow think they are the moral agents of society. And yet, actually, most of these guys, Coca-Cola, you know, coming out recently, you know, they're in it for the profit. You know, they're not kind of doing this because they think, hey, this is morally best. They're doing it because they're trying to be on the right side of arguments in order to keep the customers happy.
Yeah.
And yet we're somehow persuaded that actually these guys are, they've got it right, you know, and that they know what's best. So, it just fuels this confusion between you've got guys who are all out for profit, trying to make money, raise share prices, now defining what is good and right in a culture and a society, which they're trying to shape for their own good and benefit, not because they're concerned ultimately about culture and shape.
Yeah, but I think the point, although, you know, there's loads you could say about that denying free thought and all those things, but actually, to your point, Josh, we can't get rid of morality. We just have to recreate it somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Which is a positive argument for God and an argument for the absurdity of there being no God, because we're looking for a higher standard all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually looking for an authority figure. We want someone to tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Although we kind of instinctively rebel against it, we also do want an authoritative word. Everyone wants that. Everyone wants to know, you know, what's the truth about COVID, or, you know, what's actually the best economic argument? What's the right thing to do in this situation?
And what's fascinating, I think, is that in the sort of kick against the Christian ideology that's been prominent in our country and in the West over recent years, secularism has attempted to supplant God's rule and God's values, I suppose, and we've been left with fallible human beings coming up with new rules every day. You can't use this word anymore, and if you do, you'll be publicly you know,
shamed.
You can't say that. I literally, on just before we started this podcast, I saw a premiere headline about a Spanish politician who has been banned from Twitter for saying that men can't have babies, men can't get pregnant. And you just think, who is coming up with these rules, new rules, and then prosecuting people for breaking their new rules? And it's all a result of kicking back against the rule of God and replacing the rule of God with secular human-made ideals and values, which ultimately have no ground. And that's why all of these arguments then come out, because it's like, well, you're saying that I can't say this, but what right or authority do you have to tell me I can't do that? And it becomes this mess of values and confusing ideas that have no grounding.
Well, and I think that what you're highlighting is that push on absurdity, isn't it? That actually, for a Spanish bloke to say, look, do you know what? Men can't have babies. We all know that's biologically true.
Yeah.
You know, but the absurdity of being able to say, actually, you can't say that now because it might offend. Or, you know, the J.K. Rowling, argument about, women are women. And all these kind of things just shows you the absurdity. And I think actually, in one sense, this kind of push is going so far, it's beginning to show this absurdity.
I agree.
Just to the everyday, unbeliever, because they're going, that's absurd. Because, but what's happened is we're so frightened that people are frightened to be able to say that and express it, because they don't want to be seen to be on the wrong side or to be shamed for holding such a view. But actually, when you get into conversations with people, they'll go, that's absurd. Mm. You know, the person who wants to be defined as a tree, asexual, like all of these combinations now, and people are just going, this is absurd. Mm. You know, there's a case in Canada of a 40-year-old bloke who, wanted to be identified as an 8-year-old girl and, to be fostered in a home, and he is fostered in a home. People rationally go, that's just, crazy. Mm-hmm. And actually, where's, before you even get to safeguarding issues and all those, but, I think we're beginning to see the absurdity.
Absolutely.
I think even it's generally been right-wing politicians who've seen that more. I mean, Douglas Murray, you mentioned, Josh, when we were sort of preparing, and he did an interview on Unbelievable, was it?
Yes,
who's a gay guy who writes The Spectator and Telegraph and various stuff. And
really helpful
books,
isn't he?
The Madness of Crowds and others. Mm-hmm. He is maybe not strangely, but slightly strangely, really pro-religion.
Yeah.
Thinks, and he's a good critic of the Church of England in all its liberalism, because he kind of says, what's the point, really?
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, sort of stand up for what you actually believe in.
Exactly. Preach the gospel or shut up.
Yeah. So he would be considered right-wing. But I was even seeing there was some left-wing, or you could say left-wing, Labour peers and politicians saying, to do with gender recognition, that this is becoming absurd, where you can't even have meaningful statistics.
Yeah.
They were just making the point that, if you're trying to work out whether female crime has gone up or down, it's completely skewed if you can't define what a male and a female is.
Mm.
And particularly as quite a lot of male crime can be committed by people who trans to female, it's skewing all the figures, and they're kind of seeing how it becomes absurd.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of kind of traditionally more socially liberal groups who are also seeing something of it.
So we've sort of highlighted the process, the logical process that happens in the thinking of remove God from the picture, life becomes meaningless because ultimately it ends in nothing, so it is nothing. And we've discussed a little bit about what that leads to in terms of on a societal level, like what that looks like, because I think we're living through that now.
Yeah.
In what way does God's existence actually change that? Like, how does God then, because someone could turn around and be like, well, if God exists, how does that help? What ways do you think God infuses things with meaning and purpose? Like, how does his existence flip that picture on its head?
Yeah, it's a great way to end. I was worried we were going to end on a completely low note. It's really terrible. Yeah, I think God gives us a definition, who we are as humans, people created in the image of God. He gives us purpose, why we're here. He gives us an explanation for the badness of life in terms of the fall. He gives us hope for a better future in terms of salvation. He gives us moral purpose and guidance. And so it infuses, like I like your word, the whole of life with meaning and significance. Mm. But also suffering and pain is understood and doesn't become part of that meaninglessness.
Mm.
it actually makes sense of suffering and pain too.
Mm. Yeah, really helpful. Any final thoughts, Mark?
Well, and just I think sometimes we forget the reality of that worldview. It's not just that it's a series of propositions. There's a relationship that goes on. We're relational with God, and that relationship in sense of it connects in a way that I know to be true, and begins to work itself out in the ways in which it shapes, gives hope, but my identity, encouragement, confidence, all of those kind of things of just walking with the one who has made me and knows me better than anyone else, and having that actual relationship, you know, not just some thoughts or truths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's really helpful and really interesting. I would want to say, like, be confident, Christian, because it's like you have the solid foundation on which all these beliefs that you rightly hold are built, and be confident to have these conversations, to ask those questions. Why are we here? What's the purpose of your life? Where do you find meaning? Like, you as a Christian have such strong answers to those questions in the face of secular silence from the secular side. Really, there is no strong answer. So I think these are some interesting times in which we can have those kinds of conversations with people, friends, neighbors, and even family maybe. So yeah, I'll just encourage people to be confident with those things, really, and maybe let us know if you have had those conversations, how they went. Email us, we'd like to hear those things, or questions or comments or rebuttals. That would be good too.
Wherever you are in the world,
wherever you are,
we'll have a bit of German, bit of Brazil, bit of anywhere else, please.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us for another episode. We do appreciate it. Direct your questions, comments, topic suggestions, all that good stuff, to ordinary@cchh.org.uk. Review the podcast, like, share, comment, do all that good stuff, and come back next week for another brand new episode of Ordinary.